All right, we'll call our first case on the docket today, actually the only case now, Williams versus Pollard. It's Supreme Court case 83349. On behalf of the appellant, I know there was a reply filed, so you all will have an opportunity for rebuttal if you want to reserve some time for rebuttal. Do you know? Pardon?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay. And as everybody knows, the bell being at 5 minutes anyway to let you know where you are in terms of time, okay? And do I pronounce it Krakowski?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Mr. Krakowski, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, Neil Krakowski and Carrie Maxey on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Angelita Williams. This is a pretty simple case at its core. Mr. Pollard, the respondent, loaned $500,000 to a company called Don B. Mia LLC. He alleges he was not repaid that money. He filed suit against Don B. Mia LLC and its allegedly its two owners, Ms. Williams and Mr. Godsey. And as it pertains to Ms. Williams, the only appellant in this case, Mr. Pollard obtained an order of default, followed by a default judgment. At the time, back around 3 years ago, that judgment was valued at about $1.6 million. Ms. Williams ultimately filed a motion to vacate that default judgment under Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 60B, as well as a motion to vacate the district court's entry of default. The legal argument that she made in the district court was the fact that she was never served with process. She never received any notice of this lawsuit until it came up during her bankruptcy proceeding, and she swore to that in an affidavit that was filed with the motion. Nonetheless, the district court denied Ms. Williams' motion to vacate the order of default and the order of default judgment. In this particular case, we ask that this court reverse the district court's denial of the Rule 55C and Rule 60B motion, because at the time the district court entered default and default judgment, it did not have the authority to exercise personal jurisdiction over Ms. Williams. We know that for two reasons, and they act separately and independently. The first reason is that...
Let me interrupt you for a moment. How was that, if at all, litigated down below, this idea of personal jurisdiction?
So I think that the issue of personal jurisdiction was specifically litigated below in the context of not being served with process. And that was the argument that was made in the context of the Rule 55C and the Rule 60B motion. That was a
60B1 motion is what was argued. And as far as excusable neglect and not the service of process issue, you're trying to jump back and say, well, it was void and therefore the court didn't have any jurisdiction without looking at any of the time frames.
Right. Well, so I think that there are two parts to that, Your Honor. The first is that yes, 60B1 was specifically referenced, but that is not to say 60B4 was not an issue. I think that this court has specifically addressed the appropriate standard in the Dobson decision when it says that 60B4 is the appropriate standard when you're arguing that something is void. I think that's the first part of it.
Well, and that wasn't specifically argued down below. Counsel didn't present that. And everything that was written and presented was a 60B1. Without really even mentioning 60B4.
I agree that 60B4 was not specifically referenced below, but I don't think that it necessarily had to be when you look at Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 7.
But
that,
how is it error if the court doesn't just jump in and it's got to be plain error? And how can you say that because it wasn't argued below, that the judge needs to jump over and make that determination to respond to it?
And I think, Your Honor, there are two parts to that. I think first and foremost, the issue is what does Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 7 require? And Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 7 asks for the grounds for the motion, which in this case was argued. She was not served with process. The second part of that is I think that every party, starting with Ms. Williams' counsel, but also Mr. Pollard's counsel, had an obligation to identify what the appropriate rule was. And as this court made clear in Dobson, they specifically say that 60B4 is the appropriate basis to argue. In other words, I don't think that the fact that it wasn't specifically referenced by rule number is necessarily dispositive or controlling.
Counsel, if we assume that rules that 60B4 that the court below should have looked at or inferred that this was the argument that you were making, Did the court commit reversible error when your client took over a year to move to set this default aside? I mean, there's a reasonable time constraint here, and there are cases that for less time were found to be unreasonable.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. First, as a point of clarification, I did not represent Ms. Williams in the district court.
Right.
But on the substance of your question, I think that there was a reasonable amount of time in this particular case. Again, it's a multiple factor sort of analysis. First, I don't think that anything in the record specifically indicates when she actually knew about when the judgment was entered in this particular case, other than her then lawyer's statement that he learned about it 2 to 3 months before he filed the motion. The second part and the more important part is, I think under Harrison's Living Trust, I think that once we demonstrate that the judgment is void, Harrison's Living Trust establishes a presumption that you don't worry about the timeliness factor, except in two circumstances. If there's an exceptional circumstances, being one, an unnecessary delay, and two, if there's an estoppel issue in the case. Mr. Pollard hasn't made either of those. He hasn't made either of those arguments in the briefing in this case. Secondarily, I don't think that he could satisfy either an inexcusable delay or when it comes to equitable estoppel. The other thing is, I think that if you look at the court's decisions in Kaur, for example, K-A-U-R, what you find in the court's decisions is they're all fact-based. And what you're looking for is, when did the individual have actual knowledge that there was an adverse issue, in this case, a judgment? And again, the best evidence in this case comes from the statement of Ms. Williams' lawyer at the time of the hearing on the motion to vacate the default judgment, where he indicates that he knew about 2 or 3 months before filing the motion.
How did he know? And how did he find out?
Yeah, Your Honor, I appreciate that question. Again, if you look at the transcript from the hearing, what his explanation is that Ms. Williams had filed a bankruptcy. Her bankruptcy counsel contacted him, the lawyer who represented her in the proceedings below. And as part of looking at the docket, he then pulled a copy of the complaint in this particular case. That's his explanation of how that sequence of events occurred.
I'm confused. The bankruptcy counsel contacted whom?
A lawyer in Nevada, the lawyer who represented Ms. Williams below in this particular case.
But wasn't how is there a case if she learned from the bankruptcy lawyer?
Yeah, and that was in, looks like she filed bankruptcy in July of 2020 and still waited till May of 2021 to seek to set aside.
Yes, she filed, the record supports that she filed for bankruptcy on July 6th of 2020. But I want to also make certain that I answer
right.
The question.
Here, my confusion here is, how could she have retained counsel in this case? And having the bankruptcy lawyer contact retained counsel in this case, who tracked down, what case was he defending for?
Fair enough, Your Honor. Let me see if I can clarify. Ms. Williams.
Who was he retained to represent her, I guess, in this case?
Sure. So Ms. Williams filed for bankruptcy in July of 2020.
Okay.
During that case, her bankruptcy lawyer identified that there is a judgment in Nevada. The bankruptcy counsel then contacted a lawyer who Ms. Williams ultimately retained to represent her in this specific case at the point where she was filing a motion to vacate the order of default in the order of default judgment. So that lawyer, my predecessor, then pulled a copy of the complaint, which was the first time that Ms. Williams saw it. That's in her affidavit, number one, with her motion to vacate, okay. And number two, the transcript.
It just makes no sense to me. It's like she had counsel to defend her in this case that wasn't doing anything, and then the bankruptcy attorney called the counsel and says, hey, pull a complaint for me. And then
She did not have counsel to defend her in this case, the case that Mr. Pollard filed, until she filed her motion to vacate under Rule 55C and Rule 60. That was the first time a lawyer appeared for her in this particular proceeding.
Basically, you're saying that she retained counsel in this case because of the bankruptcy attorney reaching out to say there was a...
That's right. That's right, Your Honor.
So the bankruptcy attorney didn't call an already retained counsel.
That's my understanding, Your Honor. Correct.
She called some random lawyer to find out if there was a judgment, and then she hired him.
That is the way the record reads in this particular case, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a separate question, though. The job of the district court judge in evaluating whether there's reasonable time that's been expended before the motion gets filed, that's a discretionary act by the district court judge, yes?
I mean,
they've got to evaluate, was the amount of time reasonable or not?
Well, I think that the answer to that is in some circumstances. Again, I think if you look at Harris, the Harris Living Trust case, it says that it is often a discretionary call, but when the facts are undisputed, it becomes a question of law for the court to look at de novo in this case.
I would say that at best it is undisputed here, since all we really have is the attorney in this case saying, I think it was about 2 to 3 months prior. But my main question is this. Why would we reverse a district court judge who said 2 to 3 months isn't reasonable? It had already been a year. You've known for 2 to 3 months, and you still waited, and now here we are.
Your Honor, I think that question is based upon a false premise. At that point in time, they were litigating under 60B1, which has a six-month time frame. And the lawyer representing Ms. Williams made a bankruptcy-related argument that we are not advancing in this court. So I think that from a discretionary perspective, if you look at Holcomb, for example, or Hotel Last Frontier, the court applying an erroneous legal standard is automatically abuse of discretion. And I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if I could.
I'll give you an extra minute because we chewed up a lot with questions, and we'll give a responder an extra minute on their time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Schneider.
Good afternoon, Justice Herndon, Justice Lee, and Justice Perry-Gerry. David Snyder on behalf of Respondent Derek Pollard. May it please the court. I'm relatively new to this case, which might be a disadvantage in some instances, but I think that sometimes a fresh look can help the court understand or come to a clear understanding. And here I think that my viewpoint can help this court conclude that affirmance is appropriate under the circumstances. Now, my reading of the case, it seems to me that Ms. Williams' appeal presents two categories of complaints. One set she preserved below and are properly before this panel, and the other she's raising for the first time on appeal under plain error. To sort this out, I think I need to spend some time with some of the dispositive facts in this case and then address the moving papers, the hearing, the district court order before diving into the substance of some of the averments. I think it's important to note that this case is about evading service. Here we have under what was then, I believe, the 2009 version of NRCP 4, this court amended the rules of service in effective March 1st, 2019. I think it's Administrative Docket 522. So I'll note that Ms. Williams' arguments relating to the new rules, court rules don't retroactively apply. I don't think it's possible to hold Mr. Pollard to court rules that didn't exist when he was effecting service. Nonetheless, the record before the district court showed that Mr. Pollard attempted service on Ms. Williams' home at 181 Lombardi Lane in California, which we know from her bankruptcy proceedings and on her notice to appear in this court before she obtained counsel through the Legal Aid Center, that still is her home. That they attempted service on her home on Thursday, January 11th, Sunday, January 14th, Wednesday, January 17th, Saturday, January 20th, and Tuesday, January 23rd at different times of day, knocked on the door, no answer, dog barking, car in the driveway. We know from the record before the district court that Ms. Mealty, a process server, obtained her phone number on March 12, 2018 at 2:48 p.m., called her. Ms. Williams answered the phone, hung up, and then Ms. Mealty called her back and left a voicemail notifying her about this case. We know that process servers checked property records, TransUnion TLO skip tracing, Locate Plus skip tracing, California Secretary of State's website, Contra Costa County business search, the Department of Corrections in California Facebook. They sent postal orders for forwarding addresses to our home, never received anything back. They then moved the district court to serve by publication under what was then, I believe, the 2005, I'm sorry, I think it's the 2009 version of NRCP 4, which I believe controlled at the time. They served by publication. June 12th, June 19th, June 26th, July 3rd, and July 10th, all in 2018. And then, which I think is important here, to complete service under that rule, I'm sorry, it was the 2009 version of NRCP 4E1, to complete service by publication, they mailed a letter, a copy of the complaint and the summons to her address on July 24th, 2018, which she signed. I would invite the court to look on the first volume of the appellate's appendix, page 58. You'll see her signature. Compare that signature with her notice on appeal that she filed in this case, docket number 83329, pages 1 to 2. She signed receipt of service of the summons and complaint in this case, and that was in July 24, 2018. Now, I think sometimes the district court has wide discretion in determining, when you have competing facts, who the district court is going to believe. And the district court is in the best position to do that. We have an interesting timeline here where the Honorable Tiara Jones enters default judgment on May 12, 2020. And 2 months later, Ms. Williams is petitioning for bankruptcy in the United States Bankruptcy Court in the Northern District of California. And I know that in the briefing, Ms. Williams doesn't want this court to bring its attention to her bankruptcy proceedings. I think they may have made some hearsay arguments, but I would argue these are party admissions, and these are date and time stamped in the court. We know that she listed this judgment that Mr. Pollard has against her on December 1st, 2020. It is on her bankruptcy schedule. And I think it shouldn't surprise anybody when you review this pattern of behavior that when Ms. Williams had to voluntarily dismiss her bankruptcy petition on April 6, 2021, she then decided to try to move to set aside the default and the default judgment. Now that we've kind of gone through some of the dispositive facts, let's actually take a look at what's at issue and what's properly before this court. When she moved to set aside judgment, she moved to set aside the default under NRCP 55C, which incorporates the NRCP 60B1 factors. Her counsel below also cited NRCP 60C. And after looking at this for a while and trying to figure out why they cited to that rule, I think I figured it out. And maybe this panel will tell me if I'm wrong. The old rule, NRCP 60C, the 2005 version, had two elements. You had to show that you didn't get personal service and that you timely filed within 6 months. And if you made such a showing, then the burden would shift to the plaintiff to show if equitable estoppel should apply to otherwise preclude setting aside the default judgment. And I think her counsel below didn't know that this court amended the rules on March 1st, 2019. Now that same rule is actually NRCP 60D2. And I think we can tell that from the actual motion. If you look at the motion that they filed below, Ms. Williams only argues 2 points. I didn't get personal service, and my motion was timely. If she were moving to set aside a default judgment for being void under NRCP 60D4, she would be arguing that the judgment is void and making such a showing the district court why it's void, but she wouldn't be arguing timeliness. She would be arguing diligence. The words void and the words diligent don't appear in her moving paper. Because that wasn't her intention. She was moving under that rule, which is now NRCP 60D2.
Do we need to take into consideration at all this claim that there is no personal jurisdiction over her? I know that she was a California resident, however, was a manager of a Nevada LLC. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's important to note that if you do not raise personal jurisdiction in a timely manner under NRCP 12H1, you waive it. And I understand that she hadn't appeared in the case until she filed her motion for default. Now, what's interesting here is that usually when a defendant wants to challenge jurisdiction, they can move early in the case. They can either challenge it, and the district court can preside over a hearing where the plaintiff will have to show by preponderance, either at that hearing that personal jurisdiction exists, or they can make a prima facie showing and then carry that burden at trial. But here she didn't appear, she defaulted, which means she admitted the allegations is true in the complaint. So what are the allegations that were in the complaint? We have an instance here where, again, accepting the allegations is true as the complaint because she defaulted, that Ms. Williams, a California resident, along with Mr., I think, Godson, a Tennessee resident, reached into the state of Nevada and purposely availed themselves of this state's laws to create a Nevada LLC, which they used as an alter ego, ignored corporate formalities, and used it as their personal piggy bank, signed a contract with Mr. Pollard, a resident of the state of Nevada, the contract governed by the laws of Nevada, and defrauded him. It's not as if a person who comes to our state and establishes a false LLC and uses that false LLC to sign contracts under the laws of the state to hustle people, they should expect that there might be an instance where they might be hauled into court in the state of Nevada. And I think that there's case law on point that shows that, based on the what is in the complaint, that Nevada does have specific personal jurisdiction. I would direct this court to Baker versus 8th Judicial District Court, 116 Nevada 527. We have an instance there where there was a person who stayed in the Rio for just one night, and he, after hearing advertisements in California, and he was upset that his suite didn't have enough rooms. He wanted to have suit in California, but because the harm actually occurred here, and because he established contact with Nevada for that purpose, this court concluded that that there was specific personal jurisdiction there. The other case that I would bring this court's attention to is Trump versus 8th Judicial District Court, 109 Nevada 687, with very similar facts. There was an individual, Gomez, who worked for the Golden Nugget. He was under contract, and the former president tried to hire him while he was still working for the Golden Nugget. He reached into the state of Nevada, and he talked to this person, had his agents interview him, and he eventually set up a Nevada trust account as a security because Mr. Gomez was worried that the former president might have bankruptcy issues. That trust account was governed by Nevada law, and the former president wired that money into the trust. And even though Mr. Trump was not a resident of the state of Nevada and his company wasn't domesticated within the state of Nevada, this court still found that it could exercise specific jurisdiction over him because he reached into this state and set up a trust here that was governed by the state's laws. If we accept the complaint, the allegations and the complaint is true in this case, which we must because she defaulted and didn't appear, we would have to conclude that there is specific jurisdiction in this instance.
What is your view of, so Mr. Kukowski has kind of propositioned to us that personal jurisdiction was kind of inferred from some of the discussions below, and 60B4 was kind of inferred from some of the discussions below. The district court order very clearly says three things. It's not told, it's not good cause under 55, and there's no excusable neglect that's been shown under 60B. So she very clearly viewed it as a 60B1 motion and ruled upon it the same. Appears to have been no request for reconsideration or follow-up saying, hey, we really wanted to argue these two things. So my concern is the danger of this slippery slope of saying, A, that the district court should really make the arguments for somebody, kind of, versus the attorney making the argument, and more importantly for today, us kind of saying, well, this is really what was going on down there, and I know you didn't raise it to the district court, and the order didn't refer to that, but we're going to come out and say this is what it is.
I think that sometimes it's wonderful, and sometimes it's unfortunate that counsel are bound by the actions of their attorneys.
Depends on which side you're on.
Right, and you know, and I know that opposing counsel is here today as a part of the pro bono service, and I don't fault him for what happened below, but I think at the end of the day, attorneys have a great responsibility and they have to be careful about what they put in their pleadings. And I think the Dobson case actually said, if I recall reading it correctly, is that if you're going to move to set aside a default because it's void, then you need to cite the appropriate rule. And there's a reason for that. By citing the appropriate rule and making the appropriate showing, you allow opposing counsel to challenge those facts and to challenge the case law. And you're able to put something in front of the district court that leads to the best resolution of the controversy. That's how the adversarial system functions at its best. When you're actually speaking to one another, when you know what facts and what law are at issue, and the district court can act as a neutral arbiter and not kind of weigh in and pick sides and try to advocate for one side or the other. And I think down here, what happened is, for whatever reason, Ms. Williams' counsel miscited the rule that she was relying on. I really do think that she meant to rely on what's now NRCP 60B2 based on the representations that she made in her motion and at the hearing, and that the citation to 60C was a mistake. It was appropriate under the old rule, but inappropriate when she moved because this court amended the rules. And I think the district court's conclusion that your motion is not timely may actually reflect that. I think that the Honorable Monica Trujillo might have picked up on that, because her ruling wasn't that the motion isn't, that you weren't diligent, which would be the appropriate conclusion if you were moving to set aside a default for being void under B4. Her ruling was your motion is not timely, and timeliness is a function of what is now NRCP 60D2, or what was then, before the court amended the rules, NRCP 60. So she may have actually honed in and caught this. Either way, this court can affirm a district court decision if it came to the right conclusion for the wrong reasons. And I think that if we assume that perhaps the district court and the parties below weren't speaking to one another, I want to direct this court's attention to some of its case law, where it's distinguished between motions that are timely when you're moving to set aside a default and motions that are not. Generally, on motions to set aside, timely motions to set aside without knowledge, I know my time is running down, so I'll be quick, but in a recent case, Mazzano versus Townley, Justice Herndon, that you were on, a two-month delay was considered timely. In Carr versus Singh, it was a two-month delay in learning of the judgment, and this court's always erred on the side of, especially in cases that involve domestic relations like divorces and parental rights, erred on allowing those to go to the merits. Browning versus Dixon, too much was reasonable. Gassett versus Snappy, car rental within a month was reasonable. Long versus A1, 24-hour towing, 7 days is reasonable. Yochum versus Davis, a prompt application, the court didn't really say, but I would assume prompt means soon, not later. Minson versus Rolioff, within 5 days is reasonable. And Hotel Last Frontier, 1 day after entry is reasonable. When has this court said that a motion is not or is not reasonable when a party has knowledge? One of yours, Justice Perry, Gary Glider versus Wells Fargo Bank in January 14th of last year, a 13-month delay, unreasonable. A Rockland Covenant Group, two-year delay, not reasonable. Another one of yours, Justice Perry, Gary Rodriguez versus Fiesta Palms LLC, nearly 6 months, not excusable, the extreme limit of reasonableness under due process. In regards to Harrison Living Trust, a year to 18 months, unreasonable. Kahn versus Orme, 108 Nevada 510, nearly 6 months, unreasonable, where you have knowledge of the default. Union Petrochemical Corp, nearly 6 months, unreasonable. Heard versus Fishers and Cobb Sales and Distributors, 2 months, unreasonable, where you had knowledge of the default. Ms. Williams knew about this default December 1st, 2020. She didn't file to set it aside until May 16, 2021. Under this court's case law, I don't see how it could hold that the district court committed error in concluding that she did not timely move, and unless the court has any other questions, possible.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Mr. Krakowski?
Do I have one extra minute on this? Is this correct?
You do. It's 4:21.
Thank you. Let me hit a couple points here. I heard something that I think is at the heart of this case. The exact quote was, attorneys have a great responsibility. And I wholeheartedly agree with that quote. One of the responsibilities under the rules of professional conduct requires that if your adversary does not cite the controlling precedent that applies to the matter at hand, you have a responsibility to do so for yourself if you know about it. But more importantly, in this particular case, there is not a single case that Mr. Pollard has ever cited that suggests that his error in violating Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 8A1 can be waived into a $1.6 million judgment. He also did not cite a single case that justifies his complete failure to follow the rules related to service of process under Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 4.4B and 4.4C. There is not a single authority that he cites that suggests that this court can affirm a district court decision that was fundamentally violative of, in this case, Ms. Williams' rights. That case doesn't exist. I do want to hit on some of these cases that he's talking about, his long list of cases here where he says things like 2 months is good, 3 months is good, and he cites Mazzano, Carr, Running, Gassett, Yoakum, and that's what we have in this case. The attorney for Ms. Williams said, I learned about this 2 or 3 months before I filed the motion to vacate.
How do you explain, though, when she's putting the judgment in her bankruptcy petition in December?
The best explanation that I can come up with for that is that her bankruptcy counsel learned about it
in December.
That would, assuming that we acknowledge that the bankruptcy papers that have been filed are her bankruptcy, which they haven't been authenticated, that's an evidentiary issue that was never briefed and never argued.
Right.
So,
and it should have been fleshed out down below.
It maybe could have been, except for the fact that the timing of the bankruptcy. But most importantly, all of those documents from this bankruptcy proceeding come in for the first time in the record in this court. And we've outlined in our brief that they haven't been authenticated, that they are hearsay, and that there's not a good reason to take notice.
So weren't brought up down below and first time presented in this court.
And
so, yeah, we're all kind of on the same level.
And I agree. We're both new counsel to this particular case.
Sure.
The difference is that when I was making arguments that were not maybe using the terms of art that we've been talking about today in the appellant's opening brief in this case, I was justifying the legal authorities that permitted me to make those arguments, most importantly, plain air. If Mr. Pollard wanted to rely on these documents from this bankruptcy, he should have at least gone through the analysis that we heard today, admissions against interest, other things along those lines. But it's never been argued until this point in time. That's the difference. I did that work in the opening brief, giving him a chance to respond. He never did it in this particular case. And I do want to hit one more time on this timeliness issue. Again, the best evidence that we have in this case is that the attorney who appeared for Ms. Williams in the district court learned of this judgment 2 to 3 months before he filed the motion to set aside and motion to vacate in this particular case.
Did Ms. Williams previously sign a receipt of copy or the return receipt of the...
A return receipt in the record, but there is no evidence substantiating that that's her signature. In fact, this is the first time today that Mr. Pollard has advanced the argument with any sort of basis that that's her signature. There's no foundation for that particular conclusion.
Wasn't that part of the affidavit that was submitted by the process server that it was signed, and also they called the number, somebody answered, hung up, verified that it was for Angie Williams?
So a couple aspects. First, that was not part of the process server, either process server's affidavit. It was not part of Mr. Bliss's affidavit, and it was not part of Ms. Keelty's affidavit. So with respect to the certificate, that the return receipt, that came after the fact when Mr. Pollard's lawyers mailed something to the address on Lombardi Avenue. The second, but again, there's nothing that indicates that was her signature. The boxes aren't checked. May I answer the second part? I realize I'm...
You may.
All right, thank you. The second part of the second part of the question, if I understand it correctly, is this timing aspect of it. And it simply was not something that Let me back up. Will you repeat your question on the second half for me?
I'm good. I got it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Kukowski, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, thank you to both sides. I realize neither of you were involved down below, but I appreciate your work on this case. And I appreciate the Legal Aid Center's scrambling with us the last couple of weeks or so to make sure Mr. Kukowski was still able to appear today and complete his representation of his client. Shouldn't be that hard when people are doing pro bono cases to get here, so I'm thankful to the bar as well for signing off on that. All right, this matter is going to stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the next call of the court.